God knows more than they do.
Welcome to the first episode of Reading Watchmen.
I'm Jim Bob.
And I'm Joe.
And together,
we're one drink in. If you guys are first timers, we're one drink in. We host a series of companion podcasts to TV shows, books, movies at some point. And this is Watchmen. We did the TV series on HBO.
Yes.
Great show.
Excellent show, yeah.
And now that that's wrapped up, we've decided to dig into the original graphic novel.
Yeah. So if you caught the show on HBO and you've never read the comic book, I feel like this is a perfect excuse to read along with us. So we're going to be going chapter by chapter through the original 12 issues of Watchmen. And we're going to do our usual, like we did with the TV show, just like an in-depth dive on our thoughts and opinions on the issue. And then that's it. So if you haven't read chapter one of Watchmen, the 1986-87 comic series, pause this podcast, go read it real quickly. It'll only take you several hours. I don't know how long it takes you to read a comic book. Go pick it up, read it, just the first chapter, and then come right back to this point and we'll start our discussion.
And if you have an aversion to reading, fear not. They have a motion comic.
Ooh.
And it, you can find it on YouTube for free. Just go ahead and search Watchmen motion comic and pretty easy to find. I've watched it. It's pretty great. I think it it hits all the necessary bullet points. And my only complaint with the motion comic is that you have one voice for the whole...
For all the characters.
Including female characters. Yes. So it's a little weird when he's... You know, reading a female voice, but you can get over it pretty quickly.
So, yeah. Also, if you haven't seen the HBO series, basically what we're doing with this podcast is reading the comic book sort of in the context of having watched that. So we might reference a few things here and there from the TV show insofar as they're relevant to what we're reading in the comic book. So there might be some spoilers for the HBO show. But we are going to try and avoid spoiling later issues of the comic book.
And I think for the HBO show, we're probably going to save that for the end. I think a spoiler section at the end.
That's a good idea.
So that way, if you don't want to spoil the HBO show, if you haven't watched it, you can listen to the episode up until probably towards the end. We'll give you a heads up that we're going to start heading into spoiler territory for the show. And then you should probably turn it off and watch the entire series of the show before resuming the podcast. Fair?
I think so. I think it's more than fair.
I'd say so.
And you guys should all be grateful.
With that
no,
said.
No, I'm kidding. We're really grateful that you're here listening.
Thank you very much for joining us. And let's dive in. So we'll give you a little bit of a history lesson on Watchmen.
The year is 1985. The place is New York City. Or like an alternate history, New York City.
Yeah.
Where it's, you know, the height of the Cold War. That's when the comic really came out. And it's depicted here in this alternate history where Richard Nixon has been president for like a bajillion years. He never almost got impeached for Watergate. He just kept getting elected. He overturned. What is it? Which amendment?
The term limit, whatever that
is.
Yeah,
I think like Amendment 14 or something. I don't remember.
We'll go with 14.
We'll just call all of them 14. Not anybody who knows that offhand or is willing to look it up, you can go ahead and shoot us an email.
Let us know. TheOneDrinkIn@gmail.com.
But yeah, so the world of the comic book is you very much feel the tension of the Cold War turning up as the doomsday clock, the symbolic clock depicting our closeness to nuclear oblivion gets closer to midnight.
It is written by Alan Moore and illustrated by Dave Gibbons.
Yep.
And Alan Moore, what else has Alan Moore done, Jimmy?
Alan Moore's done a whole lot for comics. He is very famous comic book writer from England. He wrote V for Vendetta. He wrote The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. He wrote, what else did he do? The Killing Joke. So all like really famous comic book stories.
Famously, he loves when people adapt his work into film.
He's a big fan of Hollywood.
Yep. And DC Comics in general.
And he doesn't know a thing about witchcraft.
That's actually not true. He famously despises when anyone touches his work for any adaptation. I think he's put a curse.
He does know magic, yes.
He doesn't. Yeah, he's into some witchcraft. He does. There's a very bad relationship with DC Comics.
Yeah. And I can't say I really blame him. DC Comics has a history, sure, of maybe taking advantage of some of the works that they've gotten a hold of.
DC Comics is a bunch of scumbags. DC Comics, if you're looking for sponsorship opportunities, we are.
I wouldn't go so far as to call them scumbags, but I'm pretty sure there are people who would.
I was kind of joking. Yeah. I don't have a horse in the race here, but I could see why he would have bitter feelings towards DC Comics.
Absolutely.
So I think if my memory serves correctly, DC Comics approached Alan Moore. They had recently acquired Charlton Comics, which was some kind of small comic book company.
Outfit. Yeah. They had acquired a lot of similar companies like Fawcett Comics, who created who was then called Captain Marvel, is now called Shazam. Mm. Was originally a small comics publisher that DC then purchased. So that's how they got that character, for example. And I suppose it's the same with the Charlton Comics.
So they had recently acquired these characters, and I think they approached Alan Moore to create some stories around these newly acquired characters. But then I guess at some point they realized that Alan Moore was going to go in a very dark direction, and they were afraid that he was going to like kill off all these characters. So they told him to make like mirror versions almost. So not exact copies of the characters, mm-hmm. but inspired by them. And then you could do whatever you want with them.
Interesting. I hadn't heard that, but that's a really interesting story. I do know that he and Dave Gibbons really collaborated pretty hard on the creation of a lot of these characters. Mm-hmm. Because Alan Moore's kind of famous for many things, but one of them is writing extremely detailed scripts that sort of describe in exacting detail, you know, everything that happens on panel and how they're arranged and things like that. But it is clear that Dave Gibbons definitely the two had a back and forth relationship, that they worked together a lot and sort of developed these ideas from the both of them. So.
And I think at the time, comics were generally a little more innocent.
I would say like before then, but like the mid 80s is kind of when we see a whole bunch of really dark and gritty stories come out.
Yeah.
Watchmen being probably the best known.
Sure.
But, you know, that's also when we get the beginnings of like Neil Gaiman's Sandman. Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns. A lot of stories like that where...
dark and gritty.
Yeah. Even The Killing Joke came out about the same time.
Yeah.
And that one's pretty gnarly as well. So.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Little history lesson there. So, shall we jump in?
Let's jump in.
The issue one.
Page one, panel one.
At midnight, all the agents. So, the title of the first comic is actually taken from a line of Bob Dylan's song Desolation Row. The line is, at midnight, all the agents and the superhuman crew come out and round up everyone who knows more than they do.
Oh, my.
And apparently.
Can you sing it? How does it go? I don't know. I don't think I've ever heard this song.
I'll play it. Maybe we'll make that the intro song.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we might go that
route. Retroactively. So if you're hearing us talk about doing that in the future, you will already have heard the clip of the song.
In which case, we don't do it because Bob Dylan doesn't let us use the rights to his song. You'll have Jimmy singing his best version of Bob Dylan. So, yeah, that line of from the song resonated with Alan Moore and kind of was part of the inspiration of this comic book. So we open Rorschach's Journal.
Yes.
October 12th, 1985.
Yeah, we have some narration over a really sort of a cinematic sequence of panels that sort of zoom out from what starts at like a blood puddle on a sidewalk with a smiley face badge with a drop of blood over one of the eyes.
Now, Jimmy, you'd mentioned something in a different podcast about the 9-panel.
Mm-hmm.
Was that common at the time, or is that unique for?
It's definitely not super common at the time. So Watchmen's panel structure is Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons, for whatever reason, decided to go with this very like clean, straightforward page design where each page basically has 9 panels in 3 rows of 3. Sometimes they're joined together into like one big panel or what have you, but the proportions are basically the same throughout the entire issue or the entire series. So like it is pretty unusual because most comic books of the time and today especially would have a lot more dynamic panels, like panels inside panels and, you know, panels that take up the whole page and have smaller ones like floating around them and things like that. There's a lot less sort of visual experimentation in that sense. But it does kind of give it this sort of like standard by which it tells the story, and you can kind of. I don't know. It feels like it, as complex and interesting as this story is, maybe it helps to make it more streamlined. I don't know. But yeah, that your mileage may vary, but I kind of dig the,
I like it a lot.
The 9-panel layout
works for me. So yeah, you notice the opening, the first panel, you see the smiley face badge with what looks to be some sort of bean juice on there. I'm not sure what it looks like to
human
you.
Bean juice.
And the Rorschach is the narrator describing how corrupt the city is. And he mentions that everyone had a choice and they chose basically the wrong path. They chose evil.
Yeah, he's a very uplifting guy, whoever this Rorschach character is. He's got these like really poetic descriptions about, you know, the accumulated filth of sex and murder foaming up about people's waists and
so
things
dark.
Like that. Yeah. So, you know, this is where we start. We see two characters like walking through this puddle of blood on the sidewalk, almost like nobody cares. And it zooms like over the course of that one page, the camera is kind of like zooming upwards the whole time to show this bird's eye view, to show that, you know, this puddle that we're seeing is a result of someone having dropped from a window.
Yeah.
In a tall apartment building.
He says that they could have followed in the footsteps of good men like his father or President Truman.
Interesting.
Decent men who believed in a day's work for a day's pay. Instead, they followed the droppings of lechers and communists and didn't realize that the trail led over a precipice until it was too late.
Ah, so Rorschach is telling us a little bit about himself. He's a bit of a into the Red Scare, you know, like he mentions communists as being like, you know, a high evil, and also lechers. So like, you know, people who engage in unscrupulous sexual activity.
Fornicators, I guess, would be a...
So these are like some of Rorschach's biggest evils in his mind, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
What I find interesting is he mentions his father, but I guess we'll get into that later. I don't remember...
That is definitely a question. We'll definitely stick a pin in that.
Yeah.
Because that is an interesting point.
And then we cut to two detectives inside of an apartment. We learn that this is the victim.
Yes. So they're investigating a murder directly above this blood pool. The first detective, the first thing we hear him say is that's quite a drop. Right after Rorschach, we hear narrate that nobody has anything to say. You know, very, very astute observation. Mm-hmm. Being thrown from an apartment window would be quite a drop.
But. Quite a drop. As they're describing how the attack happened, we get you cut to visualizations of the actual attack happening.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Edward Blake's apartment.
Yeah, so they give a little exposition about, you know, who he is. They tell us that, you know, he's built like a weightlifter. So they surmise it must have been a couple of guys or multiple assailants.
Yep.
And it's kind of cool as they look around and look at the damage. It'll have a panel of them looking at, you know, the damage in the apartment. And then immediately the next panel will be like a flashback sort of overlaid in red of the actual event happening. So, yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. You know, it's the thing that one of the advantages that comics has is that you can kind of like jump around in time like that more seamlessly, I think, than you can in like TV or movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, you see Edward Blake get thrown out of the window. They say, could he have fallen out of the window? No, the glass is too thick. You'd have to be thrown, and certainly would take more than one person to throw
indeed,
that big guy out of the window.
In these flashbacks, we see him like getting beaten, and we see the drop of blood. We saw how it wound up on that smiley badge that we see at the on the sidewalk. We see him wearing it on his bathrobe, it looks like. And then, yeah, so it all comes full circle very quickly.
So then you got the detectives leaving, and they're basically talking to each other, saying we should probably keep this kind of quiet. We don't want to alert any masked vigilantes.
Yes.
Because in this world, there were a lot of masked vigilantes until it was outlawed by the Keene Act in 1977.
Yes, they definitely give you a lot of world building info pretty quickly here. And they mention one person in particular, Rorschach, who they're worried about picking up the scent of this case.
Yeah.
Now, Rorschach, we know, pretty much already has the scent of this case because he's writing a journal entry basically about it. But yeah, I guess we'll see where that goes on the very next page.
And then we meet Rorschach.
Yep. So yeah, he's we see basically a figure dressed like a gumshoe, you know, like a 1940s detective.
He's trench got
a
coat.
Fedora and trench coat and pinstripe pants, and he's wearing a mask. He's got a CO2 powered grappling gun, which is pretty cool.
Standard issue, I think, for vigilantes.
And I think it's a neat nod to, like, you know, Batman having a grappling gun.
Did he have a grapple hook?
Batman?
Yeah. Does he have gadgets?
Is sometimes, he yeah.
Okay.
But
never heard of this Batman.
Oh, yeah. He's maybe you're from a universe in which he's not a big deal. but yeah, so we see Rorschach fire his grappling hook up to the window and do a sort of like Adam West climb up the side of the building.
Right.
Until we get to when he gets to the top of the window and we see his face, that he's wearing this like trippy mask with like weird goobers, a goober pattern on it.
A goober pattern? Yeah, I think that's
what I'm going to call it from now on.
The goober. Does it remind you of a Rorschach test?
Or is it a goober test? Oh, you know what? I did not even pick up on that.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that what they call it? Like that inkblot test?
Either Rorschach? That or a goober test. I always get them confused.
I've always called it a goober test. All right,
we'll go with goober test. So anyway, Goober sneaks into Edward Blake's apartment and starts investigating.
Starts rummaging about.
It's almost like this detectives knew exactly that this would happen.
Are you suggesting that they wanted Rorschach to come?
No, I'm not suggesting that. It's just, I guess Rorschach's pretty predictable. And he finds a hidden compartment in the closet.
Yeah, so I kind of like these first two pages here, or not first two, but you know, these two pages where he's investigating. Because like, there's like no dialogue, but all these little, like, show him like looking around. He takes a coat hanger and uses it to measure the closet. Like he notices the closet is a little weird. Like it sticks out from the wall too far or something. And so he finds a button. And when he opens the closet, it reveals a bunch of like what some people might mistake for S&M gear, but is superhero gear. And he finds this photograph, like a bunch of weapons, a mask, and a photo of a bunch of costumed people standing, getting their picture taken.
Yeah. Turns out this is actually the Gimp's apartment from Pulp Fiction. And that's where he keeps his costume in the closet.
Get the Gimp. Gimp sleeping.
And that's the end of that scene.
Yeah. So there's this cool scene transition where we have basically Rorschach looking at this photo that he found in Edward Blake's apartment. And then the next scene is the same photo hanging on somebody else's wall, the wall of Hollis Mason, as he's talking to Dan Dreiberg.
And so I thought this was interesting. You mentioned that they zoom in on that same face, the mask, that costume.
Mm-hmm.
And as you see that face, the dialogue talks about how he went to the supermarket buying dog food for old Phantom.
It looks exactly like the Phantom. Yes.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
That was no accident. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. The same domino mask and hood. If it was like purple, bright purple.
Exactly.
I
pulled it up after I saw that, and they're basically dead ringers.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then he's, but anyway, the also funny with that dialogue is he's in the store and he runs into the Screaming Skull, a former vigilante.
Or a former enemy.
Former like masked villain, I guess. Put him away dozens of times.
And other, that might also be part of the Phantom reference, because like skulls are like the Phantom's thing, like a symbol.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's pretty cool. And then he says wham, which I think is sort of a Batman thing.
I think wham is... Or no, that's Slam Evil.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was for the Phantom movie. So the tagline for the Phantom movie that came out in the 90s or whatever, starring
Billy Zane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The tagline was Slam Evil, which is, I think, probably one of my favorite taglines for a superhero movie.
We're gonna have to do a podcast on the Phantom next.
Oh my God, I'd be down.
I think we should. Oh my.
And so, yeah, it turns out we got basically these two former vigilantes reminiscing about, you know, the good old days of fighting crime.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of mentions this perspective that you really never would think of with a comic book superhero, where he bumps into a retired villain in the grocery store and they exchange numbers. And like, he's like, oh, you know, he's actually a nice guy now. He found Jesus. I thought that was really cool. Because
so good.
You know, like you imagine, you wouldn't imagine like an elderly Bruce Wayne bumping into the Joker
right
in a grocery store and being like, oh, how you been, Joke? Like hanging in there, you know, still killing people or whatever. And
Joker's in his Sunday best. Right. Just left church.
He never smiles anymore.
And he mentions that Dan is a better night owl and that it's a shame they were forced to retire in 77. So we get more references to the Keen Act in 77, where all mass vigilantes were forced to retire.
Indeed. We also get this establishment that both of these guys played sort of two generations of a similar character.
Yeah.
They both went by the name Night Owl. And so they've kind of kept in touch. They have this sort of legacy bond as superheroes. Neither one of them is like, one's obviously retired because he's old, the other one's retired because it's illegal, but you know, they're kind of living in this nostalgic sort of situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's kind of reinforced by once Dan starts to leave and you see like that it's an auto repair shop that Hollis lives in, and the sign says like obsolete models are a specialty.
Nice.
So yeah, kind of like reinforcing this idea that this is very nostalgic for them, that like they're kind of living in the past.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was cool.
I like that a lot. Yeah, Dan, it sounds like they hang out regularly.
Yeah.
This has been going on for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Dan mentioned that it's the only thing that keeps him going.
Which is, kind of interesting. You know, I feel like a lot of people, Dan's what, like mid-30s, and like the thing that quote unquote keeps him going is hanging out with this like dude in his 60s or 70s, right, drinking beer and talking about beating up bad guys, you know, right, back in the day.
Yeah.
So I feel like that tells us something about Dan.
Yeah.
Especially. Yeah.
So Dan says it's getting late. He heads home. And we cut to the next scene. And I want to point out
It's like we see his progression in a series of panels.
Yes.
And we kind of see there's a lot of little details. So like the thing about Watchmen and about any Alan Moore story is every panel is just packed with background details and things that sort of describe the world to you just from the pictures, just from looking at it.
Mm-hmm. And you see we're going to find out later that they're called Knot Tops, but guys, they look like typical, like, I don't know, 80s
gangsters
with their boombox, and they're listening to some music. One thing that's interesting is anytime, I think every time you see any song, it's an actual song. Like the lines of dialogue from the song are from actual songs.
Interesting.
So this particular one is Iggy Pop, the song Neighborhood Threat.
Oh,
so they're pretty I would call them neighborhood threats.
Not exactly self-aware, maybe.
Yeah.
It's also interesting to note that like the cars don't look like typical 80s cars. Mm. They're weird looking. They're more like sort of oval, rounded vehicles.
Yeah.
And it turns out that they are, for the most part, electric cars in this world.
Interesting.
Yeah. Hmm.
So yeah, you see Dan walking home and he approaches a big building that says, floors 1 through 4, Dryburgh D.
Yeah. So he owns 4 whole floors of this apartment building and there are 3 other tenants, it looks like.
Right. So he's clearly got, some money,
some means, a Bruce Wayne type.
As he approaches the front door, it has been broken into.
Yeah, he finds that his door has been kicked in, and he still doesn't really hesitate. He goes in. I guess the old superhero instincts are kicking in, and he sees none other than our friend Rorschach, who is helping himself to some beans, which is weird, but that's cool. And he says it doesn't even need them heated up. He's
like some cold.
Yeah, this is so Rorschach, that he has a history with Dan, as we see in this scene. Mm-hmm. And also he's a weird dude. Like he'll just bust into your house, kick in the door, like never mind like calling and being like, "Hey Dan, right. Cool if I come over later."
Could have just knocked.
And then helps himself to the beans.
Yeah.
Very strange. But he is here to show him the smiley face badge.
Yep.
Which is where we get our favorite term in the comic, human bean juice. As Dan asks if there's bean juice on it, he says, no, it's human bean juice.
That's right. Rorschach came to tell him that the comedian is dead.
Ah, so that's who Edward Blake was.
And he suspects that someone's picking off masked vigilantes.
Yeah, and so Dan, very reasonably, I think, sort of asks him, or points out that sounds a bit paranoid.
Right.
Because it totally does. Like Rorschach jumps from investigating one murder to assuming that it must be like a pattern. Like there's a mass vigilante killer.
Right.
Without any evidence. And there's, you know, only one, it's definitely paranoid. Like yeah. I feel like it comes like right out as being very obviously messed up. And he takes offense to that assertion.
Is that what people are saying about me, that I'm paranoid?
Yeah.
Right. It's a very paranoid thing to say.
It is.
And then Dan argues that it could be a burglary or a political killing because the comedian was working for the government. So he'd probably have a lot of political enemies.
Yeah. So I think Rorschach shoots down the burglary thing pretty credibly because, as the detectives pointed out, the comedian's pretty built. Like
sure.
An ordinary burglar is probably not going to be able to beat him. But a political enemy?
Political enemy possible. But then later Dan kind of squashes that, saying, you know, with the Dr. Manhattan on the U.S.'s side, no one's really going to mess with the U.S.
Which maybe. Feel like that's still kind of a stretch, though.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever Dan is holding on to, I guess.
So we see Dan's got a big basement with some very large object covered in some blankets.
And dust.
And dust. And then let's Rorschach know that he can leave through the basement. There's like a secret exit.
Secret tunnel that they used to take back when they were partners.
When they were partners. And whatever happened to them being partners?
Well, the Keene Act happened in 77.
But Rorschach
says, as we've been told several times,
You quit.
Yeah.
Blaming Dan for
that's
quitting.
That's the way Rorschach sees
it. He was pretty much forced to. Rorschach just decided he wasn't going to play ball.
And then we see, so yeah, Dan, kind of confronted by this, collapses as Rorschach leaves, looking at the comedian's badge and sitting next to his, we see his costume, like an owl costume in the corner, which I think is pretty sweet.
Pretty cool looking.
But yeah, so reinforcing this idea of Dan Dryburgh living in the past and having this like nostalgia You know, like I feel like that's kind of a relatable thing for people in our generation nowadays, like this nostalgia is a drug sort of idea.
They like the member.
Member berries. Yeah. Like everything from our childhood's coming back because it's marketable to
us. That's right.
We have disposable income now.
So then Rorschach leaves and we get another entry in Rorschach's journal, October 13th, 1985.
He mentions how he slept all day, that he's...
this awful city screams like an abattoir full of retarded children, which I didn't know what abattoir was. Do you know?
It's a slaughterhouse.
Slaughterhouse. Yeah. Of retarded children.
It's a lovely image, yes.
On Friday night, the comedian died in New York. Someone knows how.
So here we see Rorschach preparing to basically go about his like superhero investigating his own. See what his methods are of solving a crime like this.
Right.
Step one is go to Happy Harry's bar, which looks like a shady hole in the wall. And as soon as he walks in, Happy Harry recognizes him and starts flipping out. Basically,
doesn't look too happy to see him.
Is just like, okay, just please don't kill anybody.
Yeah.
Rorschach apparently has a reputation.
Clearly has a reputation, right? So he's asking around, mentions that the comedian died. It was a friend of his. Someone makes a wisecrack about him having a friend who must have changed his deodorant.
Whoa.
And that's all Rorschach needed.
Rorschach starts
breaking pinkies,
applying the old I was gonna think of something, some clever way of describing that, you know, like five finger discount, but that doesn't work. You know, it's like, you know, what would you call like getting information by breaking fingers? Hey, hit us up on email if you can think of like a really clever way to describe interrogating somebody by breaking their fingers.
He doesn't get any answers. The people there claim that they don't know anything. So he leaves disappointed. And he says he's got business elsewhere with a better class of person.
Better class indeed, as we cut to a huge, ominous tower.
Very menacing
in
looking.
In a rainstorm.
Yeah.
So
Veidt Tower.
Rorschach has visited someone named Adrian Veidt. At the top of his tower, and he's got this, you know, lavish office. He's a well-dressed, well-put-together fellow who apparently is also a former vigilante superhero. And he explains that he retired from vigilantism before the Keene Act because he's, you know, at least his PR people had him pegged as the smartest person in the world, smartest man in the world. And so then he capitalized on his superhero image by selling action figures and stuff like that because... I mean, that's pretty brilliant.
It's pretty good business move. Sure. Yeah. Adrian Veidt thinks that he says the same thing Dan said. Maybe it was a political killing. He had a lot of, he was practically a Nazi.
Rorschach
takes kind of offense to that.
Yeah.
And says he stood up for his country, Veidt. He never let anybody retire him.
If that makes him a Nazi, you might as well call me a Nazi too.
That's right. Never set up a company selling posters and diet books and toy soldiers based on himself.
Yeah,
never became a prostitute.
He sees that as a form of prostituting oneself, which prostitution is something Rorschach looks very much down upon, as he's mentioned it a few times now.
I do think one could argue, though, that if the comedian was basically a puppet for the government, that would be kind of a type of prostitution.
Oh, absolutely.
So I don't know that he's correct in... you know.
Well, sure. Yeah, you could say, but I'm just bringing up the point that like prostitution in general is like a label Rorschach uses to everything he hates.
I get what you're saying. I'm just saying that Rorschach's defending. He's saying the comedian
is not a
prostitute.
Yeah.
But in one way, you could argue that, yeah, he probably was. You know, he didn't quit being a vigilante because he played ball with the government.
That's a good point.
So, yeah, they mentioned the Keene Act again. And you see on Ozzy's desk, he's got a bunch of action figures.
Yes.
One of them is bent over in a very suspicious looking pose. What do you think he was doing to that toy?
I think, is that the one Rorschach was playing with? He picks one up and is messing with it.
Maybe.
Maybe he throws it back on the desk in that way.
Bent over, looking around.
We do see on that newspaper is a reference to the doomsday clock standing at 5 minutes to midnight.
Yes.
So I think that might be the first direct reference to it. For anyone who doesn't know, the Doomsday Clock is like a real thing. It's this symbolic clock that symbolizes like how close we are to, as humanity, to certain jeopardy.
Armageddon.
Yes. Currently here in our world in 2020, the Doomsday Clock is, I think, at 2 or 3 minutes till midnight.
Is that real?
Yeah.
Who's the authority on the Doomsday Clock?
There's like a, I can't remember what they're called, but they're like this organization of scientists and whatnot. And one of the reasons they moved it so close is because, in addition to the threat of nuclear war, is also the threat of environmental and ecological disaster as well. So
sure.
Yep.
Oh boy. Rorschach leaves. Meeting with Veidt left a bad taste in his mouth. Possibly homosexual. Must remember to investigate further.
Yeah, a very interesting leap there.
I love how it must remember to investigate further. Like, that's a very important thing.
So it also makes me wonder, like, just how many other, like, lists of weird accusations he has that he's, like, looked into people on, or he's investigated people. Like, how many times has he like followed Dan Dreiberg to the grocery store to see like what brand of beans he's buying or whatever, and what that might suggest about him?
Yeah. Rorschach would be a tough person to be friends with.
For sure.
He says, why are so few of us left active, healthy, and without disorders?
Yeah. I wonder. And as he's saying this, or as his journal is saying this, we see him breaking into Rockefeller Military Research Center, and he seems to be doing it more or less effortlessly. So he's good at what he does, mm-hmm. even if he's completely bonkers. But he makes his way into this facility guarded by armed soldiers.
Probably a very secure facility for him to just be able to sneak onto.
And he mentions that he's going to go tell the indestructible man that someone plans to murder him.
He also goes down the list of a bunch of other mass vigilantes. Talks about how the first Night Owl runs an auto repair shop. The first Silk Spectre is a bloated aging whore dying in a Californian rest resort. Captain Metropolis was decapitated.
She's retired in a fancy place in Florida. Like,
right.
his description is just, wow, just so
slanted.
Yeah, definitely.
Captain Metropolis was decapitated in a car crash back in 1974. Mothman is in an asylum in Maine. The Silhouette retired in disgrace, murdered 6 weeks later by a minor adversary seeking revenge. Dollar Bill got shot. Hooded Justice went missing in 1955. And the comedian is dead. Gives a good rundown of.
Yeah. So there's this, apparently there's a pretty big history of vigilantes who have been running around the city and possibly working with Rorschach or against Rorschach or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
They all have relationships, and he's been keeping tabs on as many of them as he could, as is reasonable, I guess. One thing that I absolutely love about what happens next with this page, he, as he talks about visiting the indestructible man, that page basically has like a mini cliffhanger, as you know, we see good evening Rorschach as this blue light is shining on him. Next page is boom. We got this huge panel of a giant blue dude doing sciencey stuff.
Very cool.
I love the way that, you know, that page turn is sort of engineered to give that little surprise.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, you get to see Dr. Manhattan in all of his glory.
All his full Monty glory. Standing like 50 feet tall, it looks.
Very tall. We meet Dr. Manhattan and Lori...
Juspezic. Or Juspezic, however you...
Or Jupiter.
Jupiter, that's what Rorschach calls her, but she quickly reprimands him for that, because that's it's basically a name that her mom took for marketing purposes. Yeah.
Rorschach is there to tell them about the comedian, but they're all very aware of it.
Yes.
Because they're on a government facility.
They also work for the government. Right. So they were notified.
They heard probably before anybody.
So what we see here, like this blue guy, Dr. Manhattan, is the only one in this world, apparently, with actual freaking superpowers.
Yes.
And so naturally, a person like that would the military would want to keep tabs in control of, because who knows what he might do otherwise.
And Laurie is there for companionship.
Yeah. So which is also kind of ties back to Rorschach accusing everybody of being a prostitute.
Yeah.
I feel like it'd be kind of hard for Laurie not to feel a bit like a prostitute at this point. You
for
know?
Sure.
She's basically being paid to keep Dr. Manhattan happy and relaxed, as she tells Dan later.
Yeah.
In this issue, which does not sound very dignified.
No.
But I don't know. Maybe she's kind of okay with that. Maybe she looks at it differently.
When he tells him about the murder, Dr. Manhattan was pretty indifferent. Is that when he talks about a living person and a dead person are the same?
Yes. A live body and a dead body have the same number of particles.
Yes.
Structurally, there's no difference. Life and death are unquantifiable abstracts. Why should I be concerned?
And Laurie is almost glad, because she has very bad feelings towards the comedian.
Yes. They mention,
understandably so.
Yeah. Rorschach and Laurie have a conversation about Hollis Mason's book, his autobiography, which mentions some accusations, anyway, about Edward Blake and Laurie's mom. And Rorschach refers to these as moral lapses.
Yeah, an attempted rape as a moral lapse.
Yeah.
And that sets Laurie off for some reason.
For some reason. Yeah. So I think it's really interesting. Like, each of these three characters in this scene have like a very different outlook on like everything.
Everything, yeah.
You know, Dr. Manhattan is more excited about finding a Gluino than whether or not a person is alive or dead. Mm-hmm. Rorschach basically regards Edward Blake as kind of a hero.
Yeah.
He seems to have this admiration for the comedian. And Laurie obviously just sees the comedian as a monster who attempted or possibly succeeded at raping her mom, mm-hmm. and broke some of her ribs and all that good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, very like a really interesting character dynamic here with these three.
So yeah, Laurie's upset. She wants Rorschach out of there. So Dr. Manhattan, poof, teleports him out of there.
Yeah, just effortlessly, he says, you need to leave. And Rorschach's like, I'm not leaving till I've had my
poof gun.
And say,
yep.
Like, he finishes his sentence in a different location. So yeah.
So then he starts walking home. Talks about how no one cares that the comedian died. Maybe his efforts are wasted.
And I do think it's funny that as he's walking, we see, you know, a lot more of these like background details. We see words like there's graffiti everywhere. Like who watches the watchman?
Yep.
We see Kristallnacht, which is the name of a band in the 80s playing at Madison Square Garden. And it's also the name of Kristallnacht is from World War II when the Germans destroyed a Jewish neighborhood, mm-hmm. and got glass all over the ground. And so they called it the Night of Crystal, the Kristallnacht.
And then there's another poster for a band called Pale Horse.
Pale Horse, yes. Which is a reference to Revelations, Death Rides a Pale Horse. Mm. Which is, there's a lot of very foreboding images of near catastrophe. The comic book is really trying to tell us that something bad's coming
soon. Something bad is happening, yeah.
And I do like how Rorschach says, you know, there's so many deserving of retribution, so many who need to be punished, so many evil people, and so little time. And then, like, as in the same panel that he says that, there is a poster for 4 more years of Richard Nixon. Hmm. So, like, so little time, but 4 more years. I thought that was kind of good.
It's great. We should mention in the after they poofed Rorschach out of there, Laurie said that maybe she'll go call Dan up.
Oh, yes. So there. Yeah, she has a continues having a conversation with Dr. Manhattan, who's just like sciencing out over here and doing all kinds of like superpower stuff. You know, he reaches his hand like into a solid panel. He has all these like pieces telekinetically floating as he examines them. He lifts a really heavy machine at some point. And he's just kind of absorbed in this work and not really concerned. And Lori's saying she's going to call him and maybe hang out because she feels cooped up in this military facility.
Understandable.
And yeah, he's like, sure, go for it. And so she calls up Dan Dreiberg.
And Dan and Lori go get some dinner.
Yeah.
Lori vents about
how Raphael's.
Her purpose is to keep John relaxed and happy. Dan says, you sound bitter. And she talks about the old days and how embarrassed she is. Her costume was so embarrassing. Yeah. Can you believe how revealing it was?
Costume.
And Dan was equally disgusted, I'm sure.
Right. So, yeah, there's a bunch of really cool little background details in Raphael's restaurant. Lori and some of the other patrons are seen smoking like these weird looking pipes, which I guess are for like tobacco, but they're just different from what we would have here in our world. And there's like a genetically engineered chicken with four legs visible in the background. And so, yeah, I thought that stuff was pretty cool.
Yeah, some world building. Things are similar but different. And yeah, Lori mentioned that the Keen Act was the best thing to happen.
Yes, which is so. Where'd we leave off?
Captain Carnage.
Okay, so yeah, Lori and Dan are having this great little conversation about Captain Carnage.
Our favorite.
One of my favorite characters in all of Watchmen. Despite this being his only mention. But yeah, he's they tell a story about how he's a villain who used to do crimes just so that he could get beaten up by superheroes.
Yeah, he had a little bit of a kink.
And so apparently he tried to pull that on Dan one time and he just walked away. And so when Lori asked...
Because Dan was familiar with him, right?
Yeah, yeah. He's like, I'd heard about his shtick. And so I just was like, you know, leave me alone. But then he tried to pull it on Rorschach. And of course, Rorschach being who he is, killed the guy.
Yeah, Lori said, whatever happened to him? Well, he tried to pull it on Rorschach and he dropped him down an elevator shaft.
I think that's brilliant. I do love how they start cracking up and...
Very, inappropriate laughing.
Yeah, but at the same time, not really. It is a funny story.
It's very funny, yeah.
And then, she mentions how there isn't that much to laugh about and Dan kind of brings it around very poignantly, like, what do you expect? The comedian's dead.
He's dead.
Which is kind of a cool... Even though he's not a very funny guy.
Right. And that's the end of the first issue.
That's the end of the first comic book portion of the first issue.
Yes. And then there's some supplemental material afterwards.
Yes. An excerpt from Hollis Mason's autobiography, Under the Hood.
Under the Hood.
In which he describes how he came to become the first Night Owl. Do you want to start us off on that one? Or?
It's a good read.
It is a good read. Maybe we don't need to discuss it a whole lot. It's basically like a lot of world building.
Yeah.
It's the first issue of this 12-part series. So, you know, this is all that has been like introducing the characters in the world a bit. And Under the Red Hood is definitely a lot more detail into what this world is like and what it used to be like before the characters we're seeing now were at the forefront.
Right. Strong themes of legacy.
Indeed.
I thought, yeah.
Yeah, almost like they reuse that theme in another adaptation of this story.
Hollis's views, or his grandfather's at least, seem close to Rorschach. They talk about how he was... I wish I had the excerpt, but...
Which part?
More like very morally just.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Had a strong sense of like right and wrong.
Right. Yeah.
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 He mentions how his grandfather sort of passed that down to his father and how he was like embarrassed about his boss's like sex toys and whatnot that he would have like on his desk.
Yeah. To make him uncomfortable.
But Hollis himself wasn't really that offended by it.
Right. That's what it was. Yeah.
And yeah, so they mention this great sort of tragic story about this Mo Vernon, who ran this auto repair shop, which again, we kind of see the seeds being planted of Hollis's current career, you know, from when he was 17, he worked in an auto repair shop mm-hmm. with his dad. And now that's what he does as a retiree.
Yep.
But yeah, the sad story about the owner of that shop, who was apparently like a pretty fun sort of free spirited guy,
yeah.
Who found out that his wife was cheating on him, and
with his like head mechanic,
yes,
or whatever,
with his main yeah. employee, yeah. And so as he's putting on like a fake pair of boobs to like, you know, pull a gag on the guys, when he finds out about this, and he just mentions it as, you know, Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries is playing. And everybody starts cracking up because it's just a ridiculous situation. Because
he's wearing fake boobs and crying.
Says that his wife has cuckolded him. And yeah, it's just such an absurd situation. Everybody starts cracking up. And even though they apologize to him later, he winds up offing himself. And so Hollis Mason refers to that as like the saddest thing he can think of.
Yeah.
He's pretty dead on. That's pretty sad.
Pretty sad. Oh, man. He also mentions Superman. Hollis, when he was a cop.
Action Comics number one.
He borrowed a comic from one of the kids on his beat. And I think he was embarrassed to read the comics because he was an adult at the time and comics were generally for children.
Right.
But he really enjoyed
that. Just like in today.
Exactly. And then he also recounts what inspired him to wear the mask. He remembered reading a headline of
Hooded Justice.
Hooded Justice.
Yes, none other than the first masked vigilante, in at least in this world.
Yeah.
Also inspired by Superman, presumably. Apparently started a whole trend in which people started putting on masks and fighting crime and just doling out justice in the way they saw fit.
Yeah, so it sounds like Hooded Justice was the first masked vigilante, and then Hollis Mason was quickly the second. He was very inspired by it. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much it.
So, yeah, do you want to jump into some spoilery stuff?
Spoilery stuff, yes. So that is the first chapter. If that's all that you want have read so far, then perhaps this is your jumping off point.
Yeah, we appreciate you coming along the journey with us. Check out our website. OneDrinkIn.com and follow us on our socials and do all the internets,
all that stuff. If you like this podcast, best way to support us is to like us, subscribe us,
leave us a review,
on
your podcast platform of your choice.
We are also doing a new podcast covering The Witcher on Netflix. So if that's something you'd be interested in, check that out too.
Indeed. And if you haven't seen HBO's Watchmen or listened to our podcast on that show, we have one out already. It's called Watching Watchmen. And it's basically like this, except it's about the TV show.
Exactly. All right. So spoilers. This is spoilers for everything. Graphic novel and TV show. Yeah.
Citizen Kane. Everything.
Right. Where do we begin?
So since we know that Rosebud is a sled.
What were some of the things? So I noticed early on in the episode, they place the detectives pass a place called the
Gunga Diner.
Gunga Diner.
Yes.
Which Vietnamese. Uses, an elephant.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. So one thing we probably could have mentioned, but didn't, because it is just a background detail, is how Vietnam has become the 51st United State in this world after the U.S. wins the Vietnam War.
Yes. And in the show, the elephant is a
symbol of one of the characters, Lady True.
Yep.
So, yeah, definitely a cool callback. I do love also how the Hood of Justice thing, how you mentioned Hollis Mason being inspired by Superman.
Uh-huh.
We see in the comic or in the TV show, I mean.
Yeah.
Will Reeves is inspired by Superman as well, right before he becomes Hooded Justice.
Hooded Justice, exactly.
Yeah, and turns out he was in the same class, he graduated NYPD Academy in New York the same year that Hollis Mason did. So they were probably in that room together.
Probably.
Getting their badges when we see that in the TV show.
I wonder if anybody whispered "Beware the Cyclops" to Hollis Mason.
Hollis Mason's white, so he might have been a part of the Cyclops and didn't know it was a bad big deal.
Yeah,
it's like, what? Everybody's in it.
We were just goofing. Also, at one point, they pass a big sign for nostalgia.
Yes.
Which
a fragrance by Veidt.
Yes. Fragrance by Veidt, but also nostalgia in the TV show is the chemical that contains memories.
Yes.
So just amazing tie-ins.
Just full circle.
Yeah. They mentioned the Pale Horse concert. We saw that in the TV show.
Yeah. So in the TV show, Pale Horse has become a documentary about what happens at the end of this comic book series. Do we want to go into that, or maybe we'll save that?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody knows, but yeah.
Just the same. Like, even though this is the spoiler section, I think there are some things we maybe can afford to save for later.
It looked like Adrian Veidt had his, like a mini vivarium outside of his tower.
Yeah, it does seem to foreshadow the dome that we will see later in the comic and we have seen in the TV show.
Those were the main little highlights there. So yeah, reading the under the hood, a lot of tie-ins to the show.
Absolutely.
Like I was smiling as I'm reading it.
Smiling just like Dr. Manhattan on page 23, panel 9, when Laurie mentions that, or when Laurie's talking to Dan on the phone, Dr. Manhattan is giving a subtle smile, which I want to go ahead and stick a pin in that because, like, 12 or so, like 11 episodes from now, I think it's going to call back in a cool way. And I remind me.
That smile?
Yes, if you remember to bring that up because.
All right, we'll try to put it in.
I think there's something to that.
Yeah. I'm sure. He does perceive given time a little differently.
Given what we will learn about Dr. Manhattan, mm-hmm. I think that's kind of an interesting panel.
Great read. Yes. I am thoroughly enjoying revisiting this.
I have remembered how much I love this book.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely great. It's packed with detail, and the characters are all crazy interesting. A lot of people, you know, kind of think Laurie is sort of like not well developed or anything in the book. I'm not sure I agree. I think she's really interesting in the book.
Yeah.
And then knowing, or at least having in my mind what she becomes in the TV show, it's kind of even more, it kind of adds more to it, you know, when we see, you know, Agent Laurie Blake,
mm-hmm.
who's the wisecracking FBI vigilante hunter, you know, it's kind of easy to see how that character emerges out of this one.
Yeah.
And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, great. Like, one of the main goals of rereading this was to see how well it tied into the show. And it's mm-hmm. just unbelievable how.
Oh, yeah. They definitely did their.
They did a lot of research.
They did their homework.
And, yeah. That's it. So stay tuned. We're going to do the next chapter next week.
Yeah. So read up on chapter 2, which is entitled, what is it entitled? Absent Friends.
Absent Friends.
Yes. So yeah, if you haven't read it, this is a perfect opportunity, perfect excuse to jump in and get into the world of Watchmen. If you have read it, why not do it again? It's pretty awesome.
And, again, the motion comic, you can, purchase it, or you can also find it on YouTube.
Okay, how much are the motion comic people paying you to push this motion comic?
That's all I've got. So thank you everyone for joining us, and we will be back next week with another episode.
One drink in, out.